How would you like a 15% discount to my daily email, the stack of stuff, the show notes, discounts to the conference, all of that? All you need to do is text the word show to 33777. You'll get the annual subscription with a 15% discount to my daily email. You'll get the stack of stuff, the links to the show notes, discounts to the conference, and so much more. All you have to do is text the word show, S-H-O-W, to 33777. Text show to 33777.
Welcome to the Eric Erickson Show podcast, Hour 3.
Greetings, America. Welcome. An hour until I go back to the greens. That's all I'm going to say. This is how much I love you. I felt guilty last week being gone all week. I didn't want to miss you this week, particularly with Talk 650 KSTE in Sacramento coming on board while I was on vacation. So I left the Masters. I've come. I'm doing my show. I'll go back. I love you. I hope you reciprocate. Just know how much I love you. It ain't even. Okay, I have put off the story for 4 days. This is why the third hour on Friday is perfect. Because I remember when this book came out, two progressives, Tom Schaller and Paul Waldman, they wrote a book on white rural rage. And as you probably are aware, it is, just by the title, you don't have know nothing about the book, nothing about the authors. But their premise was essentially that white rural Republican voters are a danger to society, and there is growing rage in rural America. But there's a problem with it. Tyler Harper is a writer at The Atlantic, and he actually called a lot of the people who were cited or referenced in the other author's book on white rural rage, and it turns out that those professors said they were miscited. I mean, many of them said that they actually had only in passing commented on the authors. Then there's this Nicholas Jacobs, who's a political scientist who teaches on rural politics and actually wrote The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and Disuniting of America. Let me just read you part of this. In an interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe, Tom Schaller gave this unvarnished assessment of the rage he sees overflowing in the heartland. Rural whites, he said, are the most racist, xenophobic, anti-immigrant, anti-gay, geodemographic group in the country. He called them the most conspiracist group, anti-democratic, white nationalist, and white Christian nationalist. On top of that, rural whites are also most likely to excuse or justify violence as an acceptable alternative to peaceful public discourse. Now, this triggered a backlash towards rural voters from some on the left. Amanda Marcotte, who, by the way, is an idiot, writing for Salon, says she's tired of handling rural voters with kid gloves, and the time has come to pop the racist, homophobic, sexist bubble they all live in. Michael Cohen at the Daily Beast, a columnist there, agreed, writing that, quote, these aren't hurtful elitist stereotypes by Acela Corridor denizens and bubble-dwelling liberals. They're facts. David Korn of Mother Jones, another progressive, piled on agreeing that white rural voters are the slice of the public that endangers the constitutional future of the republic. Now, this has happened time and time again. And white rural rage told progressives what they wanted to hear about white Americans who live in rural areas who don't have electric vehicles. The problem is they got so much of it wrong. Now, this guy writing says, I'm an academic who studies rural Americans and lives in rural Maine. My job and passion is to pore over reams of data, including some of the largest surveys of rural voters ever conducted. Sitting on my computer are detailed responses from over 25,000 rural voters that I have conducted over the last decade and used to publish a range of peer-reviewed and widely cited research. And I've done it all largely to make sense of why rural voters are continually drawn to the Republican Party. But here's the thing. I never found the rage. The problem with the rage thesis is much larger than the fact that my research and that of others is being misinterpreted and misunderstood. What the authors are getting wrong about rural America is exactly what many Democrats have been getting wrong for decades and appear to be doing so again in this critical presidential election year. Now, the larger issue here is this book, White Rural Rage, informed the opinions of a lot of talking heads on television and pundits on the left. It informed them, it guided them, and it shaped their beliefs on public policy, and the authors fundamentally got it wrong. So now the authors have turned not to a mainstream publication, I would consider political a left-wing publication, but it's considered mainstream by the media. That's where this guy went, this rural author study, Nicholas Jacobs. Tyler Harper, he went to The Atlantic. He wrote in The Atlantic. He also is a professor, and he wrote in The Atlantic, also considered by the media mainstream publication. So where did the two authors of White Rural Rage go? They went to the left-wing, and everybody agrees it's left-wing New Republic to attack. In fact, he writes, pillaring Donald Trump is fine. Thundering against the MAGA movement is acceptable. Deep dive analyses of the votes and voices of downscale whites, sure. But if you dare to criticize the rural whites who are among Trump's most devout followers, you'll be met with an angry rebuke. And so we have in an article in Politico by Nicholas Jacobs, a political scientist who co-authored his own book, The Rural Voter, that was released a few months before ours, and another in The Atlantic by Tyler Harper, an environmental studies professor who's made it a personal crusade to attack us in our book. These pieces illustrate some of the very pathologies so common in the way scholars and pundits alike treat rural whites. So this guy is essentially claiming that anyone attacking their book is too benevolent towards rural whites and that they're on the side of truth here. But the problem is Tyler Harper documents in The Atlantic, it's very poorly sourced. It's academic malpractice. They used, in Tyler Harper's words, shoddy methodologies, misinterpreted data, and distorted studies to substantiate their allegations. He talked to more than 20 scholars in the rural studies community, most of them cited in the book White Rural Rage. And they all disagreed with the findings of the book White Rural Rage. And so what do the authors do? They run to a liberal publication to defend themselves and attack anyone who attacks them as being too devoted to defending the racists of rural America and painting these people as racist. Here's the facts. The book White Rural Rage got these authors fawning coverage from Paul Krugman, got them in a podcast with Chuck Todd, got attacked by Charlie Kirk and others. It's a New York Times bestseller. They appeared on Morning Joe. They got lots of coverage blasting rural America because their book told the left what the left wanted to hear about a group of people they don't understand. They only look down on them when they fly over them between Los Angeles or San Francisco and New York. But in the scholarly community of those who study rural America, those scholars, many of whom are on the left, say they got everything wrong. But they don't care that they got everything wrong, because they told progressives what progressives want to hear. Now, this is one of my frustrations with so much is, you know, I get attacked by some listeners. I get attacked by people on the right for criticizing the right, for trying to hold the right accountable, for my view being that if we don't hold our side accountable, the voters hold our side accountable. We got to clean up our own house. These guys in the progressive community tell progressives what they want to hear, get to attack anyone who tries to hold them accountable, and progressives elevate them into MSNBC icons. Because the left doesn't care about intellectual honesty. They care about everybody following in line. They care about DEI and all that nonsense. They want everybody to follow in line. And then they shape the views of these people. And this is the fundamental Achilles heel of all this. When you embrace their thinking on the left and begin to believe that rural white people are all racist, Trump-supporting, bad, evil people out to destroy the country, you begin to design policies that don't just alienate those people, but also alienate their neighbors in the suburbs who know them and interact with them, who don't want their friends vilified. And in many cases, as their children then move into urban enclaves, their children don't want their parents vilified by progressives. Their children may have moved to urban and suburban areas, but they grew up in the rural parts of America, and they don't recognize the caricatures of these people on the left as they paint it. And so progressives do themselves a disservice in their circle of jerks getting together, telling themselves what they want to hear, vilifying anyone who's not like them, otherizing a large portion of America who supports Donald Trump, who they've decided are supporting Trump because they're racist, as opposed to Joe Biden's policies are detrimental to rural America. Trying to force rural Americans into EVs where they don't have the power infrastructure to charge them, trying to force farmers out of their fossil fuel-burning combines into battery-powered ones that can't plow the field without running out of energy. Democratic policies don't work. Some Democratic policies do. Progressive policies don't work in rural America. And one of the long-term goals of progressives is to get people out of rural America and into cities. And if they have to vilify rural America to dissuade people from moving to rural America, they'll do it. It is a hatred and a contempt for people not like them. And they embraced the book White Rural Rage despite now well-documented flaws in this book, despite well-documented misconstruing of data in this book, despite academic malpractice exposed in this book. Their embrace of it isn't because they believe it to be true, it's because they want it to be true. They want an excuse to hate Trump supporters. They do not want to understand Trump supporters. They do not want anyone justifying Trump supporters. They do not want anyone explaining Trump supporters. They hate them. They hate you. So a whole group of people who will lecture you and me on truth and misinformation and disinformation and the way America really is will go on MSNBC. It's not a coincidence. These guys are regulars on MSNBC explaining to MSNBC viewers the nastiness of rural America. They'll get fame and fortune, and they'll get platforms to drip with disdain about anyone, and they will begin to set the narrative of the media, which will begin to reflect in its reporting that narrative, which is so contrary to truth that a lot of Americans will further see the media for who they are and distance themselves from them. Their embrace of so many lies to affirm their hatred of others is what actually undermines them in the eyes of well-meaning Americans who are actually just intellectually curious about the subject. And in their own lived experience, realize these guys are full of garbage. But what's notable is how many prominent members of the media were willing to platform the guys who wrote White Rural Rage, and now that multiple scholars are coming forward exposing their bad scholarship, how none of the people who platformed them are willing to walk it back because they too hate you. Welcome back. It is Eric Erickson here across the nation. So just real quick, being in Augusta, there is, when you go to Augusta National, there's a road, it's Berkman's Road, and Augusta National has pretty much bought all of the property, all around it, so it can expand as it needs. And a lot of it is just vacant land that's used for parking during the Masters, except there's one house. The people who own the house will let you pay $50 to park on the property. Now, you can park at Augusta National for free. You don't have to pay anything. But you can park for $50 at this house and get up close to the gate because the family refuses to sell. It's one of those old school families. So the parents bought the property in the 1950s. Now, nobody in the family lives in the house. They rent out the house, and they'll allow people to park in the yard for a fee. And they say they're just not interested in selling. Now, you know, and I know, if Augusta National came in with the right price, they would sell in a heartbeat. But they very clearly haven't gotten the price that they want for the property. They don't have to sell it. It's one of the great things about this country. The private property rights in this country are fantastic. They can annoy Augusta National all they want, but they don't have to move. It's their property. And as long as they pay their taxes and keep up the property, they rent it out on occasion. Now they use it for family reunions. I wonder how often they actually use it for family reunions, or are they just holding it out to get a price? I find these stories very funny. When you look on property maps around the country, sometimes you see these weird zigzags. Like in New York, for example, there's this tiny little house that is wedged between, I think it's in Harlem. You got these two buildings and this little house in the middle. And it's just the homeowners of the house, they flat out refused to sell, would not sell. So everything got built up around them. And you find these things, and it's just, you kind of love the stubbornness, if you will, of some Americans who just flat out refuse to go along with everybody because it's their property. And by God, they're not gonna move. And I have a hard time not liking those sorts of people. You know they're stubborn. But, you know, like, they're really proud that this is their family land, and they're not going to give it up. In New York City in particular, you see this in certain areas on particularly in Manhattan, but more and more in Queens and the outer boroughs in New York. You see people who have these homes with buildings around them, and they've just flat out refused to sell to the developers. Even in my home state of Louisiana, I've seen situations like this where people don't want to sell, and you can't blame them. Now, the danger is you live in some states where the big property developers get the state to use eminent domain and take the property. And thankfully, the South, it's very hard to do that because of the property rules of the South. But, you know, there was that famous case, what was it, the Kelo decision, I think, where was it, Delaware, New York, or Connecticut, one place where essentially the developers got the state to buy the property and hand it over to the developers. They used eminent domain, and the Supreme Court said it was possible. A lot of states changed their state constitutions to prohibit it. Good for these people, though, standing up for their property rights, even though Augusta probably one day will get the property, and nothing wrong with that either. It is gorgeous out there. They've done a remarkable job and really benefit Augusta economically. Now, I need to tell you about the Eden Pure Thunderstorm because the BOGO is going on. You can buy one, get one free. It is an air purifier, so it gets rid of the pollen, the mold, the mildew, all that stuff floating in the air. I got to be honest with you, I don't use it that way. I use it as an odor eliminator, and it works brilliantly. You can buy one, get one free at EdenPureDeals.com. The discount code is Eric BOGO, EricBogo. You go to Eden Pure Deals. You put in Eric BOGO, you buy one, you get one free. Smoke odors, litter box odors, pet odors, musty odors, wet dog odors, frying odors, cooking odors, you name it, it'll eliminate those odors. You can plug it in with a USB cord, or you can plug it in directly to the wall, and it just works. Put it in a rental car that's smoky, the smoke odor goes away. Put it in a hotel room that stinks, the stink odor goes away. EdenPureDeals.com. The discount code is Eric BOGO, EricBogo. You buy one, you get one free. You buy two, you get two free, and it just works. And it's got electrostatic plates. You don't have to get a filter subscription for the air purifier function. It just works. EdenPureDeals.com. Eric BOGO is the discount code. I, by design, waited to really get into raw politics until here at the end of the show today, just because the election's a long time off, but I was telling Charlie and Philip that I probably wanted to do it today, having put it off, and just kind of a reset with you guys of where we are right now, because Joe Biden has secured the Democratic nomination, though it will not be official until the convention. Donald Trump has secured the Republican nomination, although it will not be official until the convention. So where do things go for the parties from here? Let me divide this, the Democrats and the Republicans, and take it that way. And again, this isn't an endorsement of positions. This is an analysis. You can feel free to disagree with the analysis. But don't be mad at me for telling you what I think. I think that Donald Trump benefits from one particular thing. He's baked into the equation. People know Donald Trump. they remember more and more fondly. That's still a big red flag I think Democrats should be paying attention to, that more and more people fondly remember the Trump years, even if they don't like him. They liked the economy. They liked the nation. They liked the stability of the world. So Donald Trump benefits from surprises moving forward. If, I mean, just take the inflation report this week. Democrats, the Biden administration was pretty convinced that inflation was not going to be bad. And turns out inflation went up. So all of these surprises tend to benefit the GOP right now. Any negative bit of news reinforces that Joe Biden is too old to be president. The age factor lingers. He's in over his head. All of that benefits Trump. The problem for the GOP is the ground game. So let me analyze it in this way for you. I think the policies at play in 2024 benefit Donald Trump. The economy, crime, inflation. I think he's finding a way to nuance a way around abortion. Those tend to benefit Trump. The policies in play in 2024 benefit Trump. The politics in play in 2024 benefit Biden. How so? Money. It is extremely expensive to run a presidential campaign. And though you can tell everyone that the election is on election day, a lot of people are going to forget unless you reach out to them, unless you try to get them an early ballot, an absentee ballot, unless you try to get them to the polls. And the Biden team is building out the ground game to do all of that, and the Trump team doesn't have the money to do that. And that's my concern about Trump. And then there is this, and I mentioned it earlier in the show. Donald Trump's core constituency are people who don't regularly vote, and Joe Biden's core constituency is people who do regularly vote. So if the people who don't regularly vote show up in November, Donald Trump wins, and if the people who show up regularly show up and those others don't, then Joe Biden wins. Donald Trump needs an extraordinary number of people who say they support him but don't actually vote to show up and vote for him. And this gets back to the political issue where Joe Biden has the money and the ground game and the operation and the people willing to vote early and by absentee, and Donald Trump does not. Donald Trump does not have the money to build out that apparatus. If he has it, he needs to focus on the swing states. He doesn't have the people committed to voting early and absentee. He's got them all convinced that's the way to get your vote stolen, so you got to show up on election day. But if there's bad weather, they don't want to show up on election day in the wintertime. All of the issues in 2024 right now lean in Donald Trump's direction. The number one issue in America right now is immigration, and Donald Trump wins on that. The number two issue in America right now is the economy, and Donald Trump wins on that. The number three issue in America right now is crime, and Donald Trump wins on that. The number four issue in America right now is foreign policy, and Donald Trump wins on that. Number five issue in America is abortion, and Donald Trump loses on that. On four of the top five issues, Donald Trump wins. On the top four issues, Donald Trump wins. But he's got to turn these people out to vote. This is why I have been saying since 2020, it was a dangerous thing for Republicans who used to win the early and absentee game to talk down the early and absentee game, to claim that early and absentee ballots could cost you the election because they could be stolen, because they were fraudulent. But the problem is we've now seen three special elections and the Virginia state legislative elections where Republicans chose to turn out on election day, and when the weather turned bad, they went home or they never showed up. Meanwhile, Democrats have been taking advantage of weeks of early voting in order to stockpile votes. That's what they did in Virginia. They stockpiled early votes. So Republicans showed up on Election Day, outnumbered Democrats on Election Day, but the Democrats had already won because of the early vote. Republicans have got to change their game on this, and that takes money. It also takes a presidential candidate who's willing to tell people to go vote early. Joe Biden's willing to do that. Donald Trump is not. So money and organization, at the fundamental political level, that's a problem. So when you're running a campaign for office, here's what you typically do. Every county in America is divided into precincts. And the goal of a candidate for a successful campaign is in the area in which they're running, you get someone in every precinct to captain that precinct, to find out the number of votes you need in that precinct, and to go find those votes for you. There's mathematical formulas you can use to figure out how many votes do I need in this precinct in order to win. And in some precincts, you don't need a majority of the votes. You just need a large enough minority to offset the majority's votes elsewhere for the other guy. And you have people who keep track of that. And you have people who find you the voters. And you have people who turn those voters out and get those voters' absentee ballot applications and get those people to the polls. And if they haven't voted early, to keep track of it so that you call them on election day and remind them to go vote. And it is a manpower-intensive operation, and it's doable, and winning campaigns do it. And Donald Trump should have a winning campaign, but he doesn't have the money to do it. He doesn't have the staff to do it. He doesn't have the operation in swing states to do it. And he's got to be able to figure that out fast. Joe Biden is building a massive operation. In fact, there's news out in the last 20 minutes that Joe Biden has decided to up his spending in the state of Georgia, which he views as a key swing state, where he's suddenly convinced that Trump may not have it locked in. Even after the Lake and Riley situation, he wants to try to play for it. So he's going to pour some money into it. On every major issue right now, Trump's on the right side. He's on the right side on immigration. Voters don't like illegal immigration. They align with Donald Trump. He's on the right side of the economy. People don't feel like they're benefiting from Joe Biden's economy. They think Joe Biden's been talking down to them. They're not happy with Joe Biden. Donald Trump wins on that issue. Donald Trump wins on the issue of crime. More and more Americans blame progressive policies for the crime situation of the country. Even in urban and suburban Democrat-leaning areas, non-white voters are with Donald Trump on the crime issue. And they're with him on the geopolitical stability. They recognize that though they lived in existential terror that every day when Trump was president, he could start World War III on Twitter, he wound up not starting World War III on Twitter, and Joe Biden is coming very close to doing so. The issues and the policies line up behind Trump. The ground game and the money line up behind Joe Biden. It makes me nervous to see all of the data about Trump's voters not being regular voters. You know what I know, the Democrats are willing to stoop to dirty tricks. This has happened, we've already seen it, where people get calls saying, hey, you know, the election's been canceled due to weather today, you need to go vote next week. And there are stupid people out there who will fall for it. And if there are stupid people who are Trump voters who fall for it, Trump loses because of the Democrats doing dirty tricks to try to keep people from voting. And you and I both know the Democrats do it, the Republicans do too, and both sides accuse the other side of suppressing the vote. Both sides do it. But the Democrats can do it to voters who don't regularly vote. The polling has begun to shift towards Joe Biden. I told you this would happen. The national polling did not factor in many cases. It turns out, I think, that it was, again, the New York Times Siena College polling has been very good. And one of the things that that poll showed is that a lot of voters just couldn't believe the GOP would actually nominate Donald Trump. And that messed with the polling because people really didn't think Trump would be the nominee, and so they could sit it out and not say they'd vote for Biden. And now that Trump is the nominee, some voters are re-engaging saying, I got to vote for Biden. I got to stop Trump. That benefits Joe Biden, of course. But that's at the national level. That's not at the swing state level. A national poll is a pretty good picture of what's happening nationally, which means Joe Biden, maybe he'll win the popular vote. But it doesn't matter with the Electoral College because the swing states matter in the Electoral College. And with the exception of Wisconsin, right now Donald Trump's ahead in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Arizona and Nevada and Georgia. Only in Wisconsin is Joe Biden ahead. But he's only barely behind in some of these other states, and that's the problem because, again, this goes to the money issue. Joe Biden has the money and the manpower and the organization and the time and the patience to draw out voters, get them to vote early, get them to vote by absentee in a way that Donald Trump doesn't have the money to do it. It doesn't have the will to do it because he's opposed to early voting. There are fundamental flaws for Donald Trump, but there are fundamental flaws for Joe Biden, the policy versus the politics, the ground game versus the momentum. Trump can overcome the ground game money problems by building strong momentum. And in a closely divided nation, every independent, malleable swing state, swing moderate voter is persuadable. And if Trump can persuade them based on the mountain of evidence that Joe Biden is in over his head and too old to be in office and all these problems were easily foreseeable, well, then he's got options moving forward. He's got good options moving forward. But I'm concerned about the money. I am. And I'm concerned about the lack of investment in ground game. It's a huge problem. As someone who's run campaigns, the ground game, the operational strength to mobilize voters to vote early by absentee and on election day and make sure they show up and track them to know whether they're there, it's something campaigns can do. But you got to build the apparatus for it, and you got to do it early. When I was designing campaigns, one of the first things we began doing was organizing precincts and areas of counties, not just counties, but areas of counties, sections of counties, precincts within counties, in order to find the people and do the numbers and do the math to find out how many votes do we need and how do we get them and where do we find them and who do we get to vote for us. And these sorts of things we're being led to believe aren't happening. They need to happen. They need to happen soon. There is a media narrative that everybody hates Donald Trump. No one will vote for him. Well, that's true in the media, but that's not true in America. And that's not what the polling shows. And now we're, the Democrats are the ones who are saying, well, the polling's got to be wrong because no one I know would vote for Donald Trump. No, I think the polling's pretty good right now. Donald Trump can win this thing. But it's going to take some discipline. And y'all, I'm telling you, Trump needs to start embracing early voting. He needs to do it. He needs to get people to vote early. Because that level of engagement, that early voting, is what's going to help the GOP in November. If the weather turns and people don't want to show up in the snow or the rain or the extreme cold, the early voting, those weeks where you can bank votes, it's going to matter. He needs to start supporting the early vote and the absentee vote, and he needs to get his voters to vote that way. And if he doesn't do it, you need to do it. You need to talk to your friends and family about it. Because the Democrats, they're going to bank those early votes, and they've got the money and the machine, the manpower to turn people out and get it done, and the GOP doesn't. It's on Trump supporters to make that happen. In Primus is a publication I have been reading for free since I was in law school, has stimulated my mind for so long. It is a free publication from Hillsdale College that you can get at ericforhillsdale.com, E-R-I-C-K, ericforhillsdale.com. You go to ericforhillsdale.com, you sign up with Hillsdale College, you get in Primus in the mail every month, and you never pay a penny for it at ericforhillsdale.com. What do you find in Primus? Some of the leading thoughts from the leading thought makers of the right, from Dr. Larry Arn, from Heather McDonald, from Christopher Rufo, from Victor Davis Hanson, from lots of others. Not me yet, but maybe one day coming. In Primus is a fantastic publication. Again, I've been reading it since law school when I needed to get intellectual stimulation outside of law books, and I needed thoughtful people talking about the current ideas of the day and how I should be thinking about them. That's where Primus comes in. It gives you thoughtful commentary on current events from a conservative policy perspective and helps you think about how to think about events. You can subscribe at ericforhillsdale.com, E-R-I-C-K, ericforhillsdale.com. It is completely free, and it is very worth it.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Greetings, America. Are you ready for your weekend? Are you ready for your master's weekend? So many, the number of people who have emailed me and said, I don't care about golf. Stop. You should watch it. You should watch it. So I got my son with me, my 15-year-old. So Rick and Sally, the friends who have the access to the tickets, they were able to get my son a junior pass to go in. So we showed up early this morning. We had to go to the main gate, get to meet a member of Augusta National. Really thoughtful, really thoughtful, well done stuff. Gave him a little book that's a scavenger hunt sort of thing to be able to fill out to keep him occupied in case he gets bored. Just a cool little thing. And then he gets a souvenir that none of the rest of us do. So makes me a little jealous. But it's cool father-son outing. But it's just, it's a neat, like I mentioned yesterday, Stuart Hagstead, I think his name is. He's a banker. He's not even a professional golfer, but he's really good at golf, and he's won amateur championships repeatedly, and so they've invited him to play the Masters. He's played among people who he's played with in amateur circles who are now professionals, and he just wants to be a banker, but he's really good at golf. You can't be really good at football and play in the Super Bowl unless you're on a team. But you can be really good at golf and be an amateur and a full-time banker and get invited to the Masters, which is the Super Bowl of golf. But it starts the season. It doesn't end the season. I was listening to a podcast about the Masters and the founding of Augusta National with Bob Jones and Cliff Robertson, and the guy who is narrating it says that golf does not have a season end, but it has a season beginning, and the season beginning is in April in Augusta, Georgia, at the Masters, and it is so. We got there early this morning, and, you know, everything was delayed yesterday because of the rain, and so their spillover today, Tiger Woods, and they stopped their round late yesterday. The sun was going down. It was almost 8 p.m. I was watching it on TV. They stopped it, so they started up this morning again, so got to see Tiger this morning, and the crowds, the cheering, the crowd is so well-behaved. It's not like a normal sporting event. I was at a Raiders game in October. The people behind us were just drunk and obnoxious. Nothing's like that at the Masters if people don't want to get booted. It's just, it's beautiful. The patrons, they call them, the fans who are there to watch are well-behaved, and nobody has a cell phone. Cell phones are strictly prohibited. So everyone is there befriending each other, having conversation with each other, and watching these players play their hearts out. There's no distractions from cell phones. It's remarkable to witness. It's fun to watch, and it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And I'm deeply honored and flattered to be able to be a part of it, particularly because, you know, Rick and Sally, they took me last year, and I had broken my heel, and I didn't realize that. I was hobbling around. I was miserable. It was pouring down rain. It was cold. And to be able to have a do-over, to be able to come back, even though you got to step out and I got to do the show, I can go back. And that's fine. It gives me a rest in the middle of the day, which is fine. And I get to hang out with you guys. But it really is. I'm not a guy who loves sports. I love to play golf by myself. I don't want a golf handicap because I don't like to play with people except real good friends of mine where we can have fun because I'm not great. But I love to be out there. I love to take my son to play golf. It's great father-son time. It's just, it's neat because once you learn it, it's something you can do for the rest of your life. Like my agent says tennis and golf. For the rest of your life, you can do them. Or you can switch to pickleball as well, I guess, at some point. But it's fun. It's fun to see these guys. Many of them deeply devout in their faith. A lot of conservatives. There aren't a whole lot of liberals in golf, I'm learning. Some of these guys listen to the show. And it's just, it's a fun, exciting thing. So all that being said, you guys have a great weekend. I'm going to go to the Masters, and I will see y'all on Monday.